Welcome to Akantra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akantra AI.
Welcome. Today we're doing a real deep dive into Frank Herbert's 1965 classic, Dune. And this isn't, you know, just any sci-fi.
Oh, absolutely not. It's way more than that. It's this incredible mix of ecology, politics, mysticism.
Right. Truly monumental. So our goal today is to really unpack this epic for you, focusing on that unique blend, the sort of galactic feudalism, but also the really heavy cost of messianic power.
And to get Dune, you kind of have to get Herbert himself. He wasn't just writing fantasies. He was a journalist, deeply into, well, ecology.
Yeah, I read about the sand dunes in Oregon, that research.
Exactly. And resource scarcity. Plus, he was fundamentally very skeptical of authority, of any centralized power. And that skepticism really shaped the book.
You can feel it. And it was complex, wasn't it? Like, rejected loads of times.
Oh, yeah. Over 20 publishers turned it down, said it was too dense, too complicated. But then it won the very first Nebula Award.
Incredible. Okay, so let's set the scene. For someone coming new to this, where are we? Or rather, when?
We are way, way out there. 20,000 years in the future, there's a galactic empire ruled by a Padishah emperor. Space travel is routine.
But crucially, no thinking machines. No AI like we might imagine.
None. That's absolutely central. It's because of the Butlerian Jihad, this huge war ages ago against thinking machines.
The Great Commandment. Thou shalt not make a machine in the likeness of a human mind.
Precisely. And because there's no AI, humanity itself had to evolve, you know, to fill the gaps.
Which led to specialized humans, right? Like the Mentats.
Yes, the human computers. And very importantly, the Bene Gesserit sisterhood, they're masters of mind and body control, wielding immense political influence behind the scenes.
Okay, so you have this vast human empire, but it all runs on one thing.
This substance.
Melange. The spice. It's everything.
Why? What makes it so valuable?
Well, basically three things. It extends life quite dramatically. It unlocks latent psychic abilities, consciousness expansion, and crucially, it enables space travel.
Yes, faster than light travel. The Guild Navigators, who are mutated by consuming massive amounts of spice, they get this limited prescience.
They can see the safe paths through folded space.
Exactly. Which gives the Spacing Guild a total monopoly on all interstellar transport and commerce. They're kind of the hidden power behind the throne.
So you've got this whole galactic structure, this sort of feudal empire with noble houses, the emperor, the guild, this big corporation, Sheila, managing wealth.
Uh-huh.
And it all depends on this single resource, the spice, which only comes from one place.
Arrakis, the desert planet, Dune. That's the pivot point for the whole story.
And this is where the central conflict kicks off, control of Arrakis.
Right. Duke Leto Atreides, head of the Honorable House Atreides, is granted stewardship of Arrakis by the Emperor.
Which sounds like a promotion, but it isn't, is it?
Not at all. It's a trap. A very carefully laid trap.
Yeah.
Engineered by the Emperor himself, who's actually threatened by Leto's growing influence and popularity among the other houses.
And he's working with Leto's enemies.
With their ancient rivals, the utterly ruthless House Harkonnen. The plan is to let the Harkonnens destroy the Atreides once they're isolated on Arrakis.
And Leto. Does he know?
Oh, he knows. Or at least he strongly suspects. He sees the danger. He represents this kind of older code of honor in a system that's become deeply corrupt.
So why accept? Why walk into it?
Because he can't refuse. Refusing the Emperor's assignment would be seen as open treason. That means immediate war, which he'd lose.
So it's checkmate, almost. Accept and face annihilation on Arrakis, or refuse and face annihilation anyway.
Exactly. He chooses to go, hoping, against hope, maybe, that he can forge an alliance with the native people of Arrakis, the Freemen. He sees their potential power.
A slim hope. Okay, let's talk about the key figures, starting with the main protagonist, Paul Atreides.
Paul. He's just 15 when the novel starts. He's the Duke's son, the heir. Highly trained, obviously, in combat, politics.
But there's something more, isn't there? Because of his mother?
Yes. His mother, Lady Jessica. She's Bene Gesserit, and she's trained him in their secret arts the weirding way.
Which is?
It's this intense discipline of mind and body. It results in almost superhuman awareness, control, and fighting ability.
And we see that tested very early on, that famous scene with the Reverend Mother Moham in the box.
The Gom Jabbar?
Yeah.
The test of humanity.
Yeah.
He has to put his hand in a box that induces unimaginable pain while a poison needle is held at his neck.
If he pulls his hand out, he dies.
Right. It tests his self-control, his awareness, and Paul passes, showing he's something unusual.
But his journey isn't a straightforward hero story, is it? It gets much darker. It almost feels like Herbert is taking apart that whole idea.
Completely. Because Paul starts developing prescient abilities, seeing the future. But it's not one clear path.
No.
He sees countless possible futures branching out. And the terrifying thing is, almost every path where he succeeds, where his house survives and wins,
leads to something terrible.
Leads to a galaxy-spanning holy war, a jihad fought in his name, killing billions. His power becomes this terrible burden, a kind of trap. Victory means unleashing horror.
Wow. And his mother, Lady Jessica, she's such a pivotal character, too. She kind of sets everything in motion, doesn't she?
She absolutely does. The Bene Gesserit had ordered her to bear Duke Leto, a daughter. They have this centuries-long breeding program.
Aiming to produce a super being, the Kwisatz Haderach.
Yes. A male Bene Gesserit who could bridge space and time, access both male and female ancestral memories. They were very close. And needed an Atreides daughter to breed with a Harkonnen heir.
But Jessica defied them.
Out of love for the Duke, who wanted a son and heir, she chose to bear him Paul. That one act of rebellion, of love over duty, threw the sisterhood's plans into chaos and put Paul on this dangerous path.
And her own journey is incredible too, especially later in the desert.
Oh, definitely. Mm-hmm. She undergoes the spice agony, drinking the water of life, which is essentially the bile of a drowned baby sandworm. Highly poisonous.
To become a reverend mother for the Freeman.
Yes, and it unlocks her own ancestral memories, the memories of all her female forebears. But there's a complication.
She's pregnant at the time, with Ilya.
Exactly. And the agony awakens the fetus in her womb to full consciousness, giving Alia access to all those ancestral memories before she's even born. She becomes what the Bene Gesserit call an abomination.
Chilling. And on the other side, the villains. Baron Harkonnen is unforgettable.
Baron Vladimir Harkonnen.
Yeah.
He's grotesque. Physically, morally.
Yeah.
Driven by pure greed, cruelty, self-indulgence. He's the perfect counterpoint to Leto's honor. His cunning drives the plot forward.
And then you have these figures of loyalty around the Atreides, like Gurney Halleck and Duncan Idaho.
Absolutely vital. Gurney, the warrior poet, fiercely loyal, who survives the initial attack. And Duncan, the swordmaster, perhaps the most loyal of all, who dies protecting Paul and Jessica. They represent the integrity Paul is trying to hold on to.
Okay, let's quickly trace the plot through the three books within the novel. Book one, Dune.
That covers the move to Arrakis. The sense of foreboding, setting up the administration, trying to understand the planet, the initial encounters with the Fremen, and then the betrayal.
The betrayal comes from inside the household.
Yes. Dr. Wellington Yeh. He's a Sook doctor, supposedly conditioned against betrayal, which makes it even more shocking.
Why does he do it?
The Harkonnens have captured his wife and are torturing her. They promise her release if he helps them. So he disables the shields around the Atreides fortress in Arrakeen.
And Leto is captured.
Yes. But even in defeat, Leto tries one last gamble. Yeh gives him a fake tooth filled with poison gas. Leto tries to bite down on it when he confronts the Baron.
Does it work?
He misses the Baron, but kills the Baron's twisted mentat, Peter DeVries. A final act of defiance.
And Paul and Jessica manage to escape.
Just barely, with Duncan Idaho's help initially, and then into the deep desert. Which brings us to book two, Mod Dib.
This is all about survival and adaptation.
Like. Completely. They have to learn the ways of the desert, the ways of the Freeman, how to survive in that extreme environment. The still suits are key suits that recycle almost every drop of the body's moisture.
Water becomes the ultimate currency.
Absolutely. Water discipline is life. And Paul have to prove himself to the Fremen. This leads to a really crucial moment.
The duel.
The ritual duel to the death with a Fremen named Jamis. Paul doesn't want to kill him. It goes against his Atreides code, but Fremen custom demands it.
And he does kill him.
He does. It's a huge turning point. He sheds his old identity, accepts the harsh realities of Fremen life, and truly starts becoming one of them. He earns his Fremen name, Mod Dib.
Which is the name of a desert mouse known for its adaptability.
Yes, but the name quickly takes on prophetic significance for the Fremen, who have been seeded with legends by the Bene Gesserit about a coming Messiah.
So Paul starts integrating everything, his noble background, his Bene Gesserit training, the Fremen survival skill.
And their fighting prowess. He trains them in the weirding way, making them almost invincible. Mm-hmm. They start hitting the Harkonnens hard, disrupting spice production. He becomes a leader.
Which leads to book three, The Prophet. Mm-hmm. This is where Paul fully embraces his power.
Or perhaps is fully consumed by it. He needs absolute certainty. Needs to see the path forward clearly, so he takes the ultimate risk.
He drinks the water of life, the raw stuff.
Yes, the concentrated spice essence that's fatal to any man. But because he is the Kwisatz Haderach, or becoming him, he survives. It throws him into a coma, but he emerges, changed.
With his full prescience unlocked, seeing all time.
Essentially, yes. He sees the past, the present, the myriad futures. He has the ultimate clarity, the ultimate power, and he uses it to solidify his leadership.
Including riding a sandworm?
That's the big one. Summoning and riding Shai Hulud, the giant sandworm.
Right.
It's a legendary feat that confirms his status as the Fremen Messiah.
And then the climax, the assault on Arakeen.
It's spectacular. Paul leads the Fremen warriors, riding sandworms through a massive sandstorm, catching the Harkonnens and the Emperor's elite Sardaukar troops completely by surprise.
And they win. Decisively.
Overwhelmingly. Paul then faces Fade Rautha Harkonnen, the Baron's nephew and chosen heir, in single combat.
And kills him.
Yes. Then comes the final political checkmate. The Emperor is there, defeated. Paul confronts him.
But he doesn't just attack the Emperor.
No, he uses his ultimate leverage. He reveals he has the knowledge and the means to destroy all the spice on Arrakis. Forever.
Which would cripple the entire empire, stop space travel, destroy the economy.
Everything. He who can destroy a thing controls a thing. That's his power. Faced with that threat, the Emperor has no choice but to abdicate.
And Paul takes the throne.
He forces a political marriage with the Emperor's daughter, Princess Rulin, securing his claim to the imperial throne. Total victory.
But as you said, a hollow victory.
Deeply hollow. Because he knows with his prescience that this victory is the trigger. He hasn't prevented the jihad. He's merely ensured it will happen under his banner. He's trapped.
Which brings us right to the core themes, that messiah trap you mentioned. Herbert seems deeply suspicious of charismatic leaders.
Extremely. Paul is almost a warning. You see how this devotion, this fanaticism, just spirals completely beyond his control, even with all his power and good intentions.
It's like that quote Herbert uses, attributed to Irulan's writings.
When religion and politics travel in the same cart, they forget the precipice does not show itself to the man in a blind rush. It's a stark warning about mixing faith and power.
And the other huge theme is ecology. Arrakis isn't just a backdrop.
No, it's practically a character in its own right. The whole ecosystem, the sandworms, making the spice affecting everything, the Fremen living in balance with it. It's all interconnected.
Contrasting the Fremen's respect for the environment with the Empire's purely exploitative view.
Exactly. And water is the symbol of life, of value, community. It's about ecological wisdom being essential for survival, not just a luxury.
How does Herbert handle telling such a complex story? What about the style?
Well, he uses that third-person omniscient view, but he dips constantly into the character's internal thoughts. You're always aware of the hidden motives, the calculations.
Like seeing multiple chess games at once.
Kind of, yeah. And the epigraphs at the start of each chapter, those little snippets from Princess Irulan's future histories.
They frame everything as legend, don't they, looking back?
Right. It shifts the focus. You know, Paul succeeds in some way, so the tension becomes how he succeeds and what it costs. It adds this layer of historical weight, of tragedy foretold.
And of course, the litany against fear. I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer.
That's the core philosophy, isn't it? Self-mastery, discipline in the face of terror. It's what allows Paul and Jessica to survive. But even that discipline isn't enough to stop the larger forces Paul unleashes.
So it comes down to this paradox, destiny versus free will. Paul sees the future, but can he change it? Or does seeing it lock him into it?
That's the million-dollar question Herbert leaves you with. His prescience is immense power, but it also seems like a cage. He makes choices, but the consequences seem inevitable.
And that final assertion of power controlling the spice by threatening its destruction, it's so pragmatic, almost brutal.
It is. It shows that ultimate control often rests not on creation, but on the power to deny, to destroy.
So Dune really sticks with you because it avoids easy answers. It makes you question the very idea of a hero.
Absolutely. Paul achieves incredible things, saves his people, takes the throne. But is he a hero? Or is he the catalyst for unimaginable suffering? It's deeply ambiguous.
It really forces you to think about leadership, power, faith, and our relationship with our environment in ways that still feel incredibly relevant.
Can humanity handle transcendent power without destroying itself? Or is that cycle of creation and destruction just baked into us? It's a question that, unfortunately, never seems to get old.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.